Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you're listening to Totally EM. I have a very special guest on today. Her name is Karen Mahaney, and she is on to talk about something we have never talked about on the podcast before, but it's something that's truly important with emergency medicine, pre-hospital care, all that. We're all one big family, and unfortunately, there's something that's going on that is kind of the big secret that a lot of people don't realize is happening, or maybe they do, and there's just not a good way to change it. But unfortunately, our flight crews are probably not in as safe a helicopter as you think they are. And so joining me today is Karen Mahaney to talk about this. And Karen, could you just give us a brief introduction about yourself?
Sure, Chip. Thank you for having me today. I flew as a flight nurse for Flight for Life Colorado for 7 years. And in that time, I met the man who would become my husband, Patrick Mahaney. He was a pilot. And first he was my friend, and then he became my best friend. And then we fell head over heels for each other and were married. I then moved on and went back to the bedside to do nursing, and then went back to get my master's degree in anesthesia. And so I'm a nurse anesthetist now. Patrick was in 2015 was a pilot for Flight for Life Colorado. His history was that he was older than me. He was 20 years older than me, and he had flown as a scout pilot in Vietnam. He was in Vietnam 71, 72, and actually, when he was in Vietnam, he was shot down 3 times and uninjured in those accidents. But in 2015, now he had flown for 45 years. He was easily considered one of the, you know, one of the better helicopter in the region, not all, and maybe even the country. He was extremely experienced. He just gave a feeling of comfort and safety to his crews. He was a safety advocate, and the crews knew that. But unfortunately, in 2015, as they were taking off, as they were going to go to a public relations event, a PR event, he and 2 flight nurses were on board. The tail rotor was non-functional, and the aircraft spun out of control and was only airborne 32 seconds and crashed in the back parking lot of the hospital. Both the takeoff and the crash were caught on security cameras. And this was a first. So the NTSB had never had this kind of footage. And it's clearly obvious from the crash that within 3 seconds, the fuel is leaking out of the aircraft and is on fire. One flight nurse exits by crawling out the top, and he actually, Matt, sustained a permanent spinal cord injury, as a sacral spinal cord injury. Dave, the other flight nurse, was ejected from the aircraft and ejected into a pool of Jet A fuel. And he fully ignited, and he sustained 90% burns over his entire body, was hospitalized in critical condition for over a year. And the video, you can see Patrick is crashes onto the side where he is, and the fire ignites, and he's trapped in there. A young man, bravely from the hospital, armed only with a fire extinguisher, went in 3 separate times. Patrick was trapped in there for over 2 minutes. But he rescued Patrick out of the aircraft. You can, on the video, see that Patrick's alive. He's rolling. He's putting himself out. I just happened to be off work that day. I was within minutes of the hospital. And I was able to get to the hospital. And by that time, they had started CPR on Patrick. And I, you know, they had a ET tube in him already. And I begged him to come back to me. They vented his chest, opened up his fluids, and within minutes they got him back. And I just knelt down next to him and started, you know, thanking him for loving me and for choosing me and for being so amazing. Unfortunately, within about the hour, they lost pulses despite they were giving him blood and via rapid infuser. The plan was, it's a small community hospital. They were going to fly him into the Denver area to a large trauma hospital, and they lost pulses and they started CPR, and he went flatline. And So not only dealing with that, I saw the crash, that I was there as my husband was dying, and all of that, several months later, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, always interviews the spouse, and they've kind of nicknamed it the 72-hour widow interview, because they want to know the state of mind. And, you know, was he dealing with a stomach flu? Had you had a fight with him? Was he of sound mind? You know, what were his usual habits? They want to know all those things. And so in interviewing me, you know, letting them know what an amazing human being he was, then they just point blank looked at me and they said, well, you know, Mrs. Mahaney, this was a survivable crash if your husband had had the safety equipment on board that he should have had. And this was something I had never heard of. I had no idea what they were talking about. And then kind of sent me into a tailspin. Afterwards, I started trying to research and learn, and I reached out to a leading crashworthiness researcher named Dr. Dennis Shanahan, and he actually volunteers to help with the FAA on a lot of their research. He doesn't work for him, but he lends his knowledge to them. He let me know that there's a loophole that the FAA, I'll be back up. I thought, and I think most flight crews thought, that how when an accident happens, you have an accident happen, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, comes in and investigates. They make recommendations and what the cause of the crash was, and they give that to the FAA. The FAA is the regulating body for aviation. And then those recommendations would obviously be taken up by the FAA and implemented. And that's when I discovered that is not the case. The NTSB for years has been recommending safety measures be changed or put on aircraft helicopters. And the FAA has either pushed those to the side or said they're going to do further studies. What happened with the survivability question that the NTSB brought up to me was that back in 1989 and then also 1994, the FAA asked associations that were supposed to safeguard helicopters, make the structure, the seating and restraints, and the fuel tanks safe for the people riding in it. But at the last second, the lobbyists for the aircraft manufacturers convinced the FAA to change one word in this regulation. They changed word from the manufacture date of the helicopter to the certification date of the helicopter. You know, it sounds simple, it's just one word, but it means it's a matter of life and death. So with my husband's helicopter, it was almost brand new. It was manufactured in 2013. It crashed in 2015. It was bright and shiny, had all the, what we believed, all the bells and whistles, all the, you know, latest and greatest of avionics, and you know, had tons of power in the motor, but it was certified. That original frame was certified back in 1977. So it was exempt from these new regulations, or the regulations, the 1989-94 regulations. And so actually in talking to Dr. Shanahan, the researcher, he said, actually the regulations that my husband's helicopter fell under were from the 1960s, probably 1964-ish. And so how that translated and why they were telling me it should have been a survivable crash, the forces they guesstimated that Patrick and his crew were subjected to were about between 20 and 25 G forces. And to put that in perspective, nowadays, if you buy a Subaru car in a 30-mile-an-hour crash, you are protected up to 30 G-forces. Black Hawk helicopters, military is under different regulations than civil. So the civilian is under the FAA, the U.S. Army is under their own regulations. Black Hawk helicopters, they protect their occupants up to 40 G-forces. Like NASCAR, IndyCars, they have figured out how to protect their drivers in high-speed crashes. And those cars are very lightweight. They're just a couple men can pick those up. They can protect their drivers up to 100 G-forces. So the technology has been developed. The technology has been there and is protecting people in different walks of life. Patrick's helicopter, the Flight for Life helicopter, and all of them like them that are out there flying today, they only are required to protect up to four G forces, 1, 2, 3, 4 G forces. So that's why they were saying that he was only protected up to 4 G forces, but he was subjected to 20 to 25 G forces. If he'd been protected by the regulations from the 1989, he would have survived. And so that was a bitter pill to take. And of course, you know, in my mind, it kind of spun wildly out of control, trying to, you know, I was so angry. I had to come to a realization that I can't go back in time. None of us can, and change what happened that day. And so me being angry, me trying to make somebody pay for it, you know, or make them sorry for it, I can't do that. But what I can do is let crews know, let EMS know what is not available on these helicopters. And so by the FAA's own statistics, 85% of all helicopters flying in the U.S. today do not have to have these safety standards, the 1989. They are part of this loophole. So the odds are more than 3 out of 4 helicopters that you see are not in these safety standards. What I wanted to do was make a change. Initially, people say, you know, you can sue, that's going to make them change. But then when I really looked at it, EMS helicopters have been flying for over 45 years. And so litigation has not worked, has not made them change. So I opted not to litigate, not to sue. I opted to try to go a different route and go the legislative route. What I have drawn up is legislation and thinking outside the box, because you can try to mandate things, but that is not what the FAA likes to have done. And it's not about what the FAA wants or doesn't want. That's not what's guiding me. But there's so many different things with helicopters and safety that if you try to mandate every single little piece of safety, I'd be fighting this for the next 100 years. And to be honest, Airbus spends over $4 million in lobbyists every year. And it's just me trying to deal with this. So I could be overwhelmed, swamped, inundated with trying to counter what the lobbyists are doing. So looking outside the box, trying to look at things, turning at 180, how can we make this so, you know, trying to swim upstream, not trying to swim against the current. I've come up with a legislative idea that if a helicopter is built with the safety standards, going back to 1989-94, in terms of the seating would protect a crew member, the structure would protect the crew, and the fuel tank would, at least if it ruptured, it would not leak as fast, you know, so the crew could get away from it. And then a few other safety measures that the NTSB has been recommending. If that helicopter is built in that fashion, then when a vendor goes to buy that helicopter, it would be covered under a tax credit. And I know, I'm not looking to, you know, financially support manufacturers, but I also know that it's difficult to win when it's a business. And if that tax credit on that aircraft, so essentially you are getting an aircraft that has all the safety equipment, all the safety bells and whistles, but you would, if it's a 30% tax credit, you would be getting that safer, that new aircraft at 70% of the cost of another aircraft that's brand new that doesn't have the safety equipment. So in the business world, of course, you're going to want to purchase a less expensive, safer aircraft. And so that has been my outside the box approach, trying to turn the tides in terms of safety. Because when I call into all the FAA meetings when they're discussing this, and their take on it is very can't do attitude. You know, this is the manufacturers, you know, it'll sink them. The business is going to go under. We can't do this. We can't. Kind of similar to the tax credits that were given to renewable energy companies that kind of sparked the innovation nation side of this country of, okay, you put a carrot out there, how are you going to develop it? And so all these more cost-effective renewable energy measures that have been developed over the years are due to the tax credits. That's why the market is so heavy with it. It's providing so many jobs. And so that's been my idea, is to try to make the companies want to do this instead of using their big gun lobbyists to fight this and say, we're not going to do this. I want them to say, yes, we can do this and we are going to do this. And, you know, it's a business and I understand that. And it's not out of the goodness of their heart that they're going to do this. I want them to want to do this because that's how our crews are going to be safe, be protected, and survive these crashes that the NTSB says should have been survivable.
Thank you so much, Karen, for sharing that. I did have a few questions between reading the article and then talking to you a little bit ahead of time. So to help facilitate these changes, you've actually, like you said, have reached out to Congress, but you also met with Senator McCain. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, early in the process of trying, you know, understanding what was happening, you know, what the issue with the loophole, because it's been a slow, like an onion, slowly peeling off the layers of me understanding this. And because you have to understand, I'm not a pilot. I'm not, you know, I'm not in the business of aviation. This is all self-taught. And early on, my husband, Patrick, was going to be inducted into the National EMS Memorial. And this was in May of 2016. And I went to his company, Air Methods, and told them that how much I wanted to, you know, reach out to Congress to find a solution for this and to, you know, try to get some traction. Air Methods was very helpful and they made multiple appointments. When I went to DC, because the National EMS Memorial Induction is in Washington, DC. And so I went a couple days early and they made appointments and I met with members of the Colorado delegation and congressmen from California, congressmen from Missouri. It was kind of a smattering of congressmen that I met with. And then they had said, well, we tried to schedule you with John McCain, but we got a photo op. And so, you know, maybe you can hand him, you know, a little bit of paper information and maybe later he'll read it. Unbeknownst to me, John McCain wanted his staff to research about my husband. And when he found out that he was a Vietnam veteran and a helicopter pilot, because John McCain is an aviator himself, he said, no, give her 30 minutes. I want a 30-minute appointment with her. And so when I got there, they let me know when I arrived at his office, they said, no, you're going to get a 30-minute meeting with him, which is unheard of. And so by the grace of God, I got to go in and talk to him. And he was so amazing to sit in his presence. And he locked eyes with me. I was just a foot away from him. And he listened to what I had to say. And he sat back and he just said, this isn't right. He said, I can't believe this is being allowed to go on for so long. And he said, I'm going to tell you how we're going to get this done. He said, you go back to Colorado. You make a list of what needs to happen. You take that to the Colorado delegation. You have Colorado delegation bring that forward to Congress. And he said, and we will push this through. He said, you know, you'll have to get people from all the states to, you know, call and have their congressmen, have their senators push this through, because it, you know, just on the Colorado delegation, they can't do it themselves. But he said, we will get this through. He said, because it's the right thing to do. That's what really stuck with me, is he said, you know, he agreed with me. This is the right thing to do. I mean, this has been going on too long and it's a dirty, big secret. And that's kind of what's the footsteps that have been guiding me, is his words. And I can never thank him enough for giving me that advice, because it's really been the blueprint of what I've been doing going forward. And the good news is Representative Jared Polis from Colorado has agreed to sponsor my draft legislation and hopefully turn it into a bill. When I started this process, I had a lot of people telling me, this can't be done. You're not going to be able to change anything.
So with this draft, obviously you have a particular kind of thing in mind, and a lot of times legislation like this can be kind of lengthy, but what basically are you trying to change? Can you explain that a little bit too?
This legislation is it's an outside the box look at how to change aviation. So when you think about the car industry, safety sells. Safety makes people want to buy particular cars, or at least a certain subset of people. Some people, you know, just look at the exterior and they don't think about that. But in general, safety sells. You have the auto industry
the insurance industry pushing for safer equipped automobiles. And then you have commercials like the Subaru commercial where the young man has crashed his car and he calls his parents and his parents say, but are you okay? And he says, yes. And they said, that's all that matters. And then big on the screen, it says love. And, you know, that has been my dream that I know accidents happen. Human error happens. We can't change that. But at the very least, we can give our crews safer helicopters so that even if human error happens or weather happens, we can at least give them a chance that they can go home to their loved ones at the end of the day in spite of a crash. So what this does, this legislative draft says, is that if a company builds a helicopter that meets the safety standards from back in 1989, and then there's a couple other safety recommendations from the NTSB that I've included, if they build that aircraft, it would qualify for a 70% tax credit. So then when the company, be it the hospital, be it the helicopter vendor, goes to buy it, they get that helicopter at 70% of full cost. And so you have safer helicopters that are less expensive. And so what would eventually happen is all the existing helicopters would eventually be replaced with these safer aircraft. And that would also spark other companies that maybe initially aren't making their aircraft meet these same standards. They would figure out a way to do it and to do it in a cost-effective manner.
Essentially, you're basically capitalizing on the kind of system we have in the United States where a lot of this is driven by profits and making money and stuff like that. So, I mean, you've gone straight to the source of it with the tax credit and everything where it's something that the manufacturers want to do because it'll help sell their helicopters better. And it also gives them incentive, but also turns around and the people who are purchasing the helicopters are purchasing, like you said, safer helicopters at a decreased cost than an unsafe helicopter. So this is an easy thing to happen if it all goes through. Obviously, like anything, you know, it's up in the air. And all this is great. And this is why I wanted you to come on, because These are wonderful things that are happening, and hopefully this change happens. But this is the biggest thing I wanted you to come on for, is not only just to share the story, but what can we do as individuals who are listening to this, people who are concerned, because we all should be wanting the best that we can as far as caring for our patients, our flight crews, and everyone else. What can we do to help facilitate this change?
So Representative Polis has agreed to take this on and sponsor this, and then the plan would be to turn it into a bill. And at that point, what's going to make this move forward is members of the EMS community contacting their congressman, their senator, to say, this is the bill that's going to be moving forward. This is the issue in terms of helicopter safety and a tax credit that would eventually make helicopters that are being produced in the U.S. be safer. I need you as a congressman or a senator, I need you to be supportive of the EMS community and to vote yes on this, to help push this through. Because, you know, as we're seeing in the news today, it's the power of the people. And the EMS community is a very powerful force, because we're the caretakers of America, and we are the ones that need to reach out to our congressmen, to our senators, and say, this has to happen. It's time for you to protect the helicopter crews and make this happen.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this. And I know time's kind of wrapping up here, but is there anything else you want to share with us before you go?
My email address is saveourcrews@gmail.com. I've developed a Facebook page at Save Our Crews, and I look forward to your support in making our helicopter crews safer and be able to go home every day at the end of the day.
Well, thank you so much. And I guess without further ado, can you give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.